French fries, and Confederate statues. On Last Impressions 27, I'm Justin Katz. If we need anything right now, it's clarity. So we can work together toward resolution of our differences. That is why I'm going to start this show talking about McDonald's French fries. Malcolm Gladwell, liberal intellectual, I would say, and his very good revisionist history podcast had an episode recently about McDonald's French fries and how Phil Sokolov pressured the company. He's a millionaire in his own right, and this was his mission in the early 90s. He pressured the company to change their French fry method, and they did. Sadly, it changed. If you're a certain age, you remember the change. I vaguely remember how the old fries tasted, which was probably the hardest part of listening to Gladwell's podcast episode, was listening to him eat some that somebody had made in semblance of the old fries at McDonald's. And, you know, I don't remember specifically how they tasted, but I definitely remember that they were really something back in the day. You know, that back in those days, comedians actually had bits about how good they were, about how they wanted to drive back their car up to the drive-through window and just have them fill it full of French fries. There was just something about McDonald's French fries back then. And Sokolov did a campaign, got on TV, made a lot of noise, got the company to change. And French fries have never been the same, not since then. Life got a little less pleasurable. And, you know, it's still not clear that the alternatives were any better necessarily, you know, apart from the lack of flavor, once everything, safety, nutrition, once all of that is factored in. It's not clear that even that is a net benefit, even if you take away the flavor. But Gladwell doesn't blame Sokolov for this. He says Sokolov was just a guy trying to make the world better according to his own lights. Here's Gladwell.
It's really McDonald's that I blame. They were custodians of a French fry legacy. The fry was sacrosanct. Their own founder said so. And what did they do? They rolled over. Sold out their own heritage, as if how a French fry tastes was suddenly a secondary consideration. That's crazy.
That's crazy, says the liberal intellectual who's done many episodes about civil rights and has said, as I've noted before, it's about time that black activists were able to rewrite history in a way that's unfair to white police in the South, for example, as example was a few weeks ago. Now, I've already written quite a bit about the events in Charlottesville, Virginia, but there's one thing bothering me, and it took me a while to put my finger on it, and so I wanted to discuss it here, which is kind of the reason I started these podcasts and called them Last Impressions. So let me preface this, that it's Thursday. And as Donald Trump does, he's moved past the boundaries, past the boorishness that I'm inclined to defend by tweeting this morning about how Confederate statues bring irreplaceable beauty to our country. Maybe some are beautiful, but beauty isn't the point. And tweeting about that brings his reckless language to a new level. So I'm not necessarily talking about that. But that said, we do have an obligation to understand what people are trying to say and to identify where what they're trying to say starts crossing lines. I remember back when I was at the University of Rhode Island in the mid-90s, there was a controversy there over a cartoon that the student newspaper, the 5 Cent Cigar, published. At the time, there was some national controversy over some affirmative action policies at a college in the South. I don't remember which. I think it was Texas. And the cartoon in the student newspaper at a public college in Rhode Island, in the North, in New England, showed a white professor welcoming in a black student. And the caption was something to the effect of, "If you're our janitor, the garbage is over there. If you're one of our affirmative action students, take a seat." And it was clear in the context of the Times that the editors chose this cartoon and the cartoonist created it in mockery of the white professor in the cartoon. The activists at the University of Rhode Island didn't want to see it that way. They marched. I believe they got a bunch of concessions from the school, you know, space, a professor, that kind of thing. But one thing that's always stuck with me is I had a literature professor, very good professor, Arthur Riss, really stoked my interest largely in Nathaniel Hawthorne, Herman Melville. But one day we were talking about it, and he said that the publishing the cartoon was inexcusable. And just that unreasonable assertion, stated as dogmatic truth, it struck me. I mean, you could tell the cartoon was intended to mock the racists, but to many professors at URI, it was inexcusable. It could never be excused. You can never come back from having published this. To air in a college newspaper was inexcusable while picking a political cartoon. I mean, inexcusable to attempt to convey a message that the professors would have agreed with, but that, I think deliberately, activists made hay out of. That always has seemed to me as, I mean, college is in large part, to the extent that it's not just to learn something and get your feet wet, you know, in the adult world. It's part of the way it does that is to let you have these little dramas on a somewhat superficial scale so that you can learn from them. And what I learned from that episode was that we are on dangerous ground when we won't try to understand what other people are trying to say. So Monday night, I lost a good bit of time and sleep surfing the internet, reading various people's opinions, news reports, watching videos of the protests in Charlottesville, the car attack, the president's commentary, listening to other things related to that. And I've been just all that trying to figure out what's been nagging at me to the point that, you know, I found it worthwhile to push back on a sort of groupthink that's even affected, you know, not only local media with whom I have some longstanding issues back and forth with, who, you know, don't often mention me anymore or invite me on their shows, and that, you know, that's their prerogative. But so I push back on them, but also national conservatives, who were just not being, in my view, fair and rational. But this thing that's been nagging at me was strong enough that I did that, and I was completely sober doing it too, by the way. But what it is, what I think I've identified, is that it's the political pressures that are forcing us to pick essentially one of two false realities. And that's just not something I'm willing to do. And I don't think anybody should be willing to do that. We can be sure that President Trump's Q&A session on Monday, with a very hostile press, I think an unprofessionally hostile press. I mean, he was goading them, yeah, saying they don't do their work, they're dishonest, but they're not there to be part of the story. I didn't think. They're there to get the president's statements, and they were hostile. And so we can be reasonably certain that whatever he had actually said, I mean, even if he hadn't crossed any lines by most people's lights, he he would have been presented badly without that. I mean, he's been presented before he was, since before he was president, he's been presented badly, often unfairly. But this is the part where that has really riled people up. This is the flashpoint for what followed.
And you had some very bad people in that group, but you also had people that were very fine people on both sides. You had people in that group, excuse me, I saw the same pictures as you did. You had people in that group that were there to protest the taking down of, to them, a very, very important statue and the renaming of a park from Robert E. Lee to another name.
Now, here's the problem with the president who barrels on in his debates, who isn't necessarily articulate and more isn't willing to go back and clarify what he said. So I think it's apparent in the audio, and it's also apparent in the video, I think, that you can see in that clip when the president is talking, at the moment he said the first fine people, I think his brain was bringing up a phrase he had intended to assign to people on the other side, those who had gotten hurt and others who were just there to stand up against the racists. Now, I think he's done this. This isn't something new. He does this kind of thing. You can see it pop up. You can see him reuse phrases over and over again that are not quite fit because he's just bringing, it's like a little chunk as if it's like a piece of metadata or something. He's just inserting in his sentences, and that's how he's building his sentences. So I think he sort of confused himself in the heat of arguing, and he meant to in this press conference, he was thinking fine people association with the counter protesters. So I think he was trying to make the point about there being people who weren't necessarily full Nazis and white supremacists, who care about this issue of the statues. And when he raised fine people, he realized that he had said it about the alt-right side largely by accident. But being Donald Trump, rather than correct himself, he just charged ahead and tried to salvage the point. So he tried to revert to his prior suggestion that there were people who weren't at the extreme, even in this crowd. But I think he was thinking in terms of people who oppose taking down the statues. And certainly there are people. There are people who oppose it, you know, in kind of let it go, let us just move forward from this, and then they'll become part of our you know, history that we just becomes a big blur as we move on, and it's not worth the grief and fight and erasing of history. There are people that take that stand who have some familial or heritage in the South, familial connection or heritage, and so they have that sort of connection specifically to these statues. But being Donald Trump, he couldn't let it rest just either correcting himself or saying there are people out there in the country who support that cause of maintaining the statues, but who aren't racists. And so he, in his typical way, he had to put those people at the rally on Friday and assert that there were people in the crowd quietly protesting, and even more, I mean, as he always does, asserting that the journalists knew that and they were just lying. Now, that is too far. That is a false reality. He's insisting that his supporters acknowledge and allow and believe in as a defense against the people attacking him. Now, I want to insert a word here just briefly. Now, I posted yesterday an essay by Leah Labresco, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and it appears through this essay that she's somewhat left of center politically. But what she's arguing in specifically Christian terms is that we need to leave room, even for people who've gotten caught up in some way in this white supremacist movement. We need to leave them some room to get out of it. We need to have that path out rather than boxing them in with spikes, so to speak, if you can see the image, where they're stuck. You need a path to the right way of thinking, to the a better way of thinking. And so she points out that some of the people in that crowd probably had never seen their fellow social media tough guys up close, and this weekend might have made them uncomfortable. So there may very well have been people on the outside of that torch-carrying group who were quiet and mainly, probably not saying, I support keeping a statue up, so much as asking themselves, is this really something I want to be a part of? So I do want to make note that there were probably in that group, any group of hundreds of people, you're going to get some who are there. Somehow their feet have brought them to this position, and they probably want nothing so much as to walk away. And so it's dangerous to try to lock them in and identify them and have them fired and have their family denounce them, because where do they have left to turn? So that's just a side note. So, but the point I'm making here is that Donald Trump, as he does, this is a technique of his, I guess you could call it persuasion, as Scott Adams likes to do, but he's trying to gain assent to something that isn't real. But then there's the mainstream media and the National Democratic Party and progressives, and they're insisting that we affirm what I think is a much more substantial falsehood. And that is that the entire escalation of Antifa, anti-fascist violence doesn't exist. This thing that's been going on for months, that's not part of this discussion. It's an easy, morally clear distinction between the racists and the non-racists, when really this has been a growing national street brawl, a roving national street brawl. And there's a context to this. And there were mutual exchanges where the racists were in some cases trying to peacefully speak their abhorrent views and were physically assaulted. And they weren't the ones that crossed that line. So there was violence in both directions. Both sides do deserve blame for that atmosphere that resulted in a tragic death. Now, I've had multiple email exchanges with local news media folks. And even in that private medium, they refused to answer the question, were there violent people on the left wing side of this street battle? Were there unduly violent people in the counter protest side? And there's no other way to put this. They will not allow that to be part of the story, even in a personal email exchange. And because of that, anybody who doesn't follow alternative news media will be reacting to a dangerously skewed version of events. That's how you get Mitt Romney making as if it's easy. Anybody who's opposing racists isn't in the same park, is not comparable. Well, compare, and this is not a new analogy compare Hitler and Stalin. You can condemn both sides, and you get statements, a similar one from Representative Robert Nardolillo in Rhode Island, who's planning to run for U.S. Senate, where they're just asserting a reality that isn't true. This wasn't one-sided violence. It wasn't. And I say that it's dangerous to say that it wasn't. It was, because that sets us up. That sets these people up to be, the people who are seeding this false reality, it sets them up to be surprised at future events, the future turns of history. Now, as I've already written, history shows that groups with totalitarian intentions, they very often use a despised minority as a pretense to set precedents, to say it is okay to silence people who are bad. And all you have to do is expand the definition of bad. Now, to be absolutely clear, these white supremacist fools are deserving of derision, whereas other groups that have been persecuted as a pretense toward cracking down, such as Jews in Germany, were not deserving of derision. That's a clear distinction. But what worries me is I don't know how much that distinction, I don't know how much of a barrier it will be to expansion of the principle that it's okay to silence people. It's okay to attack a Nazi. It's okay to be the one who goes from speech to physical violence, provided that you find the other person's message offensive enough. They're already expanding that. They've been expanding that for years, decades. It just requires them to link the next step in derision to the first one. And you build societies tend to build momentum in this regard. This came to mind as I was listening this week to a Ricochet podcast featuring Bill Bennett, who's a socially conservative intellectual. He's been around a long time, mainly on the socially conservative issues. Well-known, respected person. He's held positions in, I believe, in the Reagan administration. And he's been notable for being openly supportive of Donald Trump's candidacy. And here's an anecdote he provides on Ricochet that I think illustrates this tendency to gain momentum and why we ought to be nervous expecting there to be strong barriers against expansions of this principle that there are people that you can shut up, that you can attack. He's talking about the atmosphere in Washington, D.C.
I have not seen anything like this either. It's intense. People will stop you on the street. I mean, this doesn't happen a lot, but someone stopped me on the street. I was walking back from the fitness center and said, "I just want to tell you, I don't ever want to talk to you again." I said, "Have we ever talked before?" He said, "No." But I don't ever want to talk to you. I just think that your support of Trump is just totally offensive, and I just want nothing to do with you. It's gratuitous, you know, and impolite, and all those other things. But that, it's very intense. That's the way it is.
This can go a frightening distance. There was one moment on Monday, immediately after the president gave this press conference, I played a clip of a moment ago, where Politico put up a transcript of his remarks, and there was one point. The way they were handling it was when the reporters were asking questions, there was sort of ambient microphone. They jacked up the volume, and so you could hear the question. And then when the president started talking, they would switch to just his microphone. And so there was a moment where there was a kind of a stutter in the audio, and in most cases, the person controlling the mics did a decent job of getting the switch in a place that it didn't matter. But, you know, it's tough when you're having this sort of rhetorical battle between two microphones. It's tough to sometimes know when to turn one off and one on. And at this one moment, the president was saying, "What about when the alt-left charged at them?" Meaning the alt-right, the Nazis, white supremacists, and alt-right people. And Politico, in their transcript, said made it charged at us, as if it had been some kind of a slip of the president's. He was associating himself with the alt-right folks on the ground. And even folks on the right, conservative national commentators I follow and admire generally, got caught up in promoting this as proving their point. And they accepted immediately that the president had said that when, I mean, it was so clearly inflammatory and so clearly evidence of the point that they were trying to prove that they should have checked. I mean, I did. I went back and looked at the video, and within 5 minutes, I knew they had gotten it wrong. But that's the level of the social force right now. And that can be like a tidal wave. I mean, even if you picture it coming, this looming wave, even if it hits a barrier and starts to break, it still goes on for a long, long way. Sometimes the breaking waves go farther than when you knew there was a wave coming to begin with. Hiding the reality of Antifa and the left-wing violence will only give these folks running room for momentum. I mean, the Providence Journal had a front page, top of the above the fold article yesterday on the whole thing. And in the, I think it was an Associated Press article. In there, they quoted Senator Tim Kaine, who was Hillary Clinton's vice presidential running mate. And here he is taking the moral high ground when a year ago his son was arrested as part of a group of these left-wing activists violently trying to disrupt the Trump rally. I think they had clubs and stuff, but they were also lighting off fireworks inside, I think, the Minnesota Capitol building. How do you not note that? How do you let that slide? Let's them build up this momentum that'll go farther than we want it to go, or most of us want it to go. I mean, or even look at the Obama era and the abuses he got away with, his administration. I mean, most notably the using the IRS as a weapon against conservative groups. That slid right by. If we're accepting violence in the street now because it's left-wing violence in the street, that's dangerous. I mean, now imagine the next Obama with mainstream acceptance of an Antifa-type group. It's maybe not going to be just the IRS attacking people with the president's tacit acceptance and the news media not holding them accountable. At some point, maybe, you know, the violence will just get to be too much. Well, they'll have to admit it, but it blows my mind. I mean, Politico the other day ran an article about how outrageous it was for President Trump to draw any equivalence and say there's violence on both sides. The picture associated with that was one of the black counter protesters using a homemade blowtorch to shoot fire at a guy with the white supremacist flag. That's mutual violence. There's no other way to put that. And they didn't even see, I guess, that this picture should have contradicted their thesis. And so we can't trust that those people, those guardians of free speech and the Fourth Estate, will protect our rights, when the left-wing activists really are objectively and unambiguously going too far, when they really are the bad guys. This gets back to the point, I think, that President Trump made about the removal of statues. It has seemed that the news media has largely been covering that point as a point about substance. By that point, I mean the rhetorical point that, well, where does this stop? If it's not right now, it's Robert E. Lee and Confederate soldiers. What's next? Washington, Jefferson, people who held slaves and accepted slavery in their time. Are they next? Are we going to topple their statues next? And the news media is, as I say, generally covering this as if it's just you know, a rhetorical point. Yeah, it's a slippery slope argument with no basis in reality. But Al Sharpton is already out there starting to push against the Jefferson Memorial and wants to defund it. We've long been hearing about changing the names of buildings. Today, there's a story out of Boston to change the name of a building because the person it's named out of was involved in the slave trade or in some way or something to that effect. They're already talking about this. It's not as if this is a baseless argument, and yet you're not seeing that part of it covered so much. Now, there's a good documentary put out by Vice of the events, the timeline of this weekend in Charlottesville. And it shows point blank the organizers and the driving forces of the racist rally really are terrible people with bad intentions. But it also does in its way whitewash a lot of the, no pun intended, sorry about that, but downplay a lot of the violence on the other side and makes it seem a lot more peaceful than it was overall. I mean, it's like traffic, right? When you get on the highway, sometimes you just end up in a pocket of traffic. And when you get to work, you'll say, wow, a lot of traffic this morning. And somebody who took the same route just before you or just after you, who happened to miss that pocket of traffic, would say, I don't know what you're talking about. There was no traffic. You know, if you embed with the key organizers and the most violent factions of any large group, it's going to seem like that defines the group. Whereas if you embed with the guys and gals who are there thinking it's a quiet rally they're attending and maybe even a little stunned at how it's not, then you'll probably be able to paint a, you'll definitely be able to paint a very different picture. But in this documentary, if you look, there are some indications that could be seen to serve, you know, the president's point about the slippery slope. Now, here's a, I might mispronounce this, but here's a woman interviewed in a Vice documentary named Tanisha Hudson, and they label her as a local activist. And she's talking about the state of play in Charlottesville.
This is the face of supremacy. This is what we deal with every day being African American. And this has always been the reality of Charlottesville. You can't stand in one corner in the city and not look at the master sitting on top of Monticello. He looks down on us. He's been looking down on the city for God knows how long. This is Charlottesville.
So she's saying it right there. It's Jefferson. He's sitting up there looking down on us. He's the master. The one we have to bring down, the master. It's not imaginary to pretend that that's where this is going if the momentum carries them there. That's Thomas Jefferson, Monticello. Now, it's not just Monticello, and it's not just the people who live Charlottesville and the people who live under that statue of Jefferson there. Last November, right after the election, there was a nighttime rally at the State House of the Resistance, or the Pubescence, as I prefer to call them, opposing the election that just happened. And some of the statements made were pretty shocking, and I pointed them out, especially this one I'm about to play by Mike Arujo. And I pointed out that this is dangerous talk here. And, you know, I don't think anybody in the news media dealt with it, addressed it, reported it. They turned away from it. Listen in on, here's again, Mike Arujo.
Is Trump white supremacy?
Yes! Yes! Yes!
No! He's not goddamn white supremacy! White supremacy is when we say, I'm going to send my kids to a suburban school. When we take ourselves out of the cities. And when we take the tax base out of our community, that is white supremacy. Rejecting white supremacy means that you must reject your whiteness. And if you don't, you are complicit in the murder of black bodies, in the rape of women, and in the displacement of our communities. And you know that!
You are complicit in the murder of minorities if you live in the suburbs. In the same way, I mean, you could have the argument one way or another, and it depends on what your standard of nobility and respectfulness are, but you could say Robert E. Lee, for example, was a relatively noble figure who was just complicit in the Southern racism, the slavery. That's the level of rhetoric here. It's not hard to see where this goes if we let it. If you, for living in the suburbs, are complicit in murder, and we decide as a society that it's okay to attack white supremacists, to take away their rights, knock them off the internet, forbid them to speak publicly, take their jobs away. If we say that's all right, these folks, Mike Arujo's out there right now, last year, 10 years ago probably, saying that white supremacy is just you, your whiteness. You have to reject that, which means not living in the suburbs. That's white supremacy by that definition. So let's be careful about whether we accept the premises about there's no there's no blame to opposing and beating, being involved in rumbles with white supremacists. Let's be careful about accepting that premise, because the terms can change. They can change very quickly, and it's frightening how quickly they can change. So I've argued that the definition of the alt-right has changed in this way, that a year ago when it was a controversial thing, when Stephen Bannon said the Breitbart was a platform for the alt-right, it meant something different. It somewhere in there were the racists, but there was a broad overlay that were people who were just a certain kind of conservative, mainly frustrated ones who weren't happy with the establishment way of doing things. But those people seeded the ground, and now by this point, alt-right is more or less equivalent with white supremacists. So there are probably people who haven't gotten a memo yet, haven't figured it out, but the term has changed, and yet Bannon is now being judged, much like these figures in history are judged by our new standards against the reality they were actually living in. Mike Bannon is being judged for his approval of the alt-right a year ago, and he may have said something more recently, but it's possible he meant the old definition of alt-right. But that's how quickly these terms can change. So that's why I say we need open dialogue. We need to be able to talk and expect that other people will try to understand what we're trying to say and not try to rope us into incidental uses of language that may or may not be right. Might be they will treat as Freudian slips, just like the charged at us comment by the president that he never made. There are people who want to push this thing all the way to a United States that you and I simply won't recognize. And I don't mean that in the white supremacist terms. I don't mean in terms of our racial makeup or what have you, but in terms of our principles and our rights and our plurality, our ability to be a pluralistic nation. We won't recognize our country if those things don't exist. And at the very least, we need to understand each other a little better, and even more, understand what barriers we agree ought to be in place against this wave. And I think one of those barriers is forcing people to assent to a false reality. Shouldn't be allowed, shouldn't be accepted that you have to bend the knee and say this was entirely one-sided violence, because it wasn't. The guardians of our freedom in politics and in the news media, they haven't confronted reckless talk as it's come up from the left. And there's no reason. And then, you know, that's the transverse of trying to hold President Trump to every word he utters, every way it could possibly be misconstrued or misconstrued. Yet the other side tells us right up front, we're coming for Monticello. We're coming for your whiteness. You are a white supremacist because you live in the suburbs. They're telling us that. But we're not allowed to point to it. And that's because these people who we've allowed to occupy positions of guardianship of our freedom are not holding them to account, will not even convey what they say and do if they can help it. And there's no reason to count on these guardians doing so in the future when the heat and the stakes are higher. Kevin Williamson has had a number of good essays recently on this whole thing, but one thing he said in a brief post today was the left is committed to always being on the offense in the culture wars, and that will continue. You seed ground, they'll want more ground. That's just the way it is. And we need guardians, even if you agree in principle with the left. We need people willing to stand on broader principles that can unite us. And, you know, it seems silly to bring it back to this, but just as McDonald's was the keeper of society's perfect French fry, we are the keepers of our own heritage. And no, I don't mean white heritage. And for Southerners, I don't mean Southern heritage such as it is. I mean a heritage of freedom and plurality and treating each other as countrymen, even when we disagree, because our country is an idea of freedom and treating each other as human beings. That is, I guess you could say, the flavor of the United States. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't come out right. You know, sometimes maybe it's too salty. And by certain definitions of health and well-being. It can have side effects and be unhealthy to a degree when it's abused. But that's the freedom. That's the heritage for which we fought the Civil War. And we should be very wary of those who want us to throw it away for the politics of the moment. Those aren't fine people. And we do need fine people on all sides.